My name is Mary Sue Roydebuch. I am the honored person to be with you today. I am the minister at Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society in Madison, and am very happy to be with you today. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all, and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. The poet Muriel Rukeyser once wrote that the universe is made of stories, not of atoms. Long before we had instruments to study atoms, we had voices to carry stories around fires, across generations, teaching us who we are and how to live. We gather this morning inside that old, unbroken current, a people still telling each other the truth, the way it has ever really traveled, story to story, heart to heart. Let us listen today for what runs beneath the words. A story is like a door. We walk through ourselves and come out a different door. We are changed, carrying something else. I invite you to think of a story that stayed with you. What did it leave you carrying or letting it go? Before you, you see a blue bowl. This was my grandmother's bread bowl in her kitchen in Mishawaka, Indiana. I helped her make bread in it, and while we worked, she told me stories. Some were about her, others about my dad, my aunt, my grandfather, and her neighbors. About the people she cared about and made bread for. During World War II, my grandmother became the neighborhood's bread baker. She made money for her family out of this bowl in her own kitchen. Oh, the stories she would tell me of the people in her Indiana Belgian neighborhood. And I think it was probably a good idea that I didn't understand all of her Flemish. I fell in love with all of the characters, even the crotchety ones. I knew all of them by name. I learned so much about life through them. Not only did I inherit her blue eyes, but her stories. And through the stories and this bowl, I have memories. I remember how she looked when she told them, our hands in the dough, and each time her glasses would slide down and she'd have flour all over her hands, and she'd push them back and there'd be flour all over her face. And I couldn't wait for that moment to happen. I can still tell you what that kitchen smelled like and the many pieces of comfort that filled me in her home. I remember the people in those stories, their names, their challenges, joys, sorrows. I will carry them each time I use that bowl. My family and I still make bread in this bowl and has a prominent place in our home. None of that had to be written down anywhere to survive, although I have. It just had to be told, and it's still running decades later. That's what I want to talk about this morning, not the bowl itself, but what's running underneath it. The oldest, and I'd argue still the most powerful operating system human beings have ever built is story. I invite you this morning to explore with me how story is not only a way to remember or teach. Perhaps the power of stories are much closer to an operating system. The often subconscious force running quietly underneath how all of us here move through our lives. We don't experience our operating systems. We experience the apps running on top of it. Nobody says, or I haven't heard anybody say, I used my operating system today. You say, I opened an app. Story works the same way. Nobody says, I encountered Story today. We say, I heard a great presentation, or she told me about her family and where they came from. Story is what's running underneath all of those, whether it's a sermon, a bedtime tale, a family legend, a movie, a play, a TED talk, or a parable. We might not notice it's there, but it touches us. It often becomes part of us. I suggest that an operating system does primarily three things, and I'm sure it does more. But here's what I see. It manages memory, it manages resources according to some set of priorities, and it lets programs talk to each other in a shared language. Story has been doing exactly that for us for a very long time, encoding memory across generations, transmitting values about what matters and what doesn't, and giving people who we might never meet each other a shared vocabulary for what it means to be human. That bowl is a memory management. My grandmother's bread making didn't need to be filed anywhere. It just needed a story, an experience attached to it, and it's been running in my family ever since. So, memory, priorities, and shared language. This operating system runs under nearly every tradition I could think about and every family that I know of. There are far more examples than I could ever fit into the morning, but I want to walk through you just a few at three different scales. One child, one group of people, two teachers, and a very young mom. For years, I told my son, Jeremy, a story about a bird named Felix. Does your mom and dad ever tell you stories? Well, how many of you remember stories you were told as a child? Okay. I built the stories for Jeremy out of the raw material of his day, the joys and the hard points. As a mom, an educator, and a minister, I've always trusted stories. There's something that happens when you hear your own life reflected back through someone else. Some distance opens up. You get to step outside yourself for a second and look at what happened from the outside instead of being stuck inside it. That's what Felix was for my son, a way to look at his own day without having to be in his own day. Felix was a bird. He wasn't a superhero. He was a sparrow. He didn't save humanity or win any contests. Felix was just a bird trying to get through the day, and most days, the hardest part of Felix's day looked a lot like the hardest part of my son's day. There was a bird named Juniper, who was Felix's counterpoint. Juniper wasn't a villain. She was just the bird who made things harder, who sat a little too close, who said the thing that stung, who was someday simply in the way of Felix having a good day, or so Felix thought. Every child, every person has a Juniper. And there were sparrows, a whole flock of them. Felix had to learn the way Jeremy was learning, that not everyone moves through the world the same way you do. Some birds are loud, some are quiet. Some flock together and some fly alone, and none of that is wrong. Felix had to figure out how to be a good namer of birds who weren't built like him. How many of you are still learning that lesson? So most nights, Felix would have some version of that day Jeremy had just had. He got his feelings hurt. He'd hurt someone else's by accident or not. He'd misjudge a sparrow or misjudge Juniper and have to go back and try again the next morning. I didn't tell these stories because I had a set curriculum. I told them because it was 7:30 at night and my son was carrying something he didn't have words for yet. It was bedtime, and this was a way to start through the day. And Felix gave him a way to hold it at arm's length and still look at it. That's memory management. Running at the smallest possible scale, one bird, one boy, one bedtime at a time. But the same operation runs at scales far larger than a single family. It's how individuals and groups of people have kept themselves moving through the gift and messiness of life. Long before any of us wrote anything down, Native peoples across the continent were running story the same way as infrastructure, not entertainment. Knowledge of the land, the harvest, the ancestors, the right way to live alongside each other, none of it was stored in a file. It was stored in a person and passed mouth to ear, around a fire, out in a field, around a table, generation to generation. If the story stopped moving, the knowledge died with the last person who held it. Story wasn't decoration on top of the culture. Story was the culture's memory system, oral tradition, the same system, doing for a whole people what Felix did for one boy at bedtime. Now, the second thing I think an operating system does, it manages resources according to a set of priorities, according to a set of values. Look at two very famous teachers in two different centuries. One used story to do exactly that, not just parents at bedtime or elders around a fire, but teachers who shaped how entire faith traditions think about how to live. This is a story we understand that was told by Jesus, and it's one of the ones that has probably traveled the farthest outside of church walls. A father has two sons. The younger one asks for his inheritance early and leaves for a distant country where he spends everything. When the money's gone, so are his friends, he ends up feeding with the pigs, hungry enough to envy them their food. He decides to go home, not expecting forgiveness, just hoping to be taken on as a hired hand. But his father sees him coming from a distance and runs to him. Doesn't wait for the apology, doesn't ask where the money went, just runs to him, arms open wide. Then he calls all to celebrate and kills the fatted calf because the father says, "My son was dead and he's alive again." The older brother, who stayed and worked and never strayed, hears the music and celebration and refuses to go in. He's not wrong to be angry. He's given everything and never even given a goat for a party with his friends. His father comes out to him too, and doesn't argue him out of the feeling, just says, "Everything I have is yours." There's no miracle in this one, no water into wine, no storm called. It's a parenting story. It's a love story with a kid who made a bad decision and a father who chooses love over ledger keeping, which is probably why it survived so well outside of church. You hear the prodigal son in classrooms and therapy offices and family arguments and have nothing to do with religion at all. And notice it doesn't stay abstract. Depending on the week you're having, you might be a different character in it. Sometimes you're the younger son, hoping there's still a way back in after you've made a mess of everything. Sometimes you're the older one, doing everything right and feeling invisible for it. And sometimes you're the father trying to figure out what love actually looks like in the moment it's tested, rather in the moment it's easy. The other teacher we'll talk about, whose story has carried far and wide, is Buddha. 5 centuries earlier, on the other side of the world, and one of the stories that's carried his teaching furthest outside temple walls is a story about grief. A mother loses her child and carries the body from house to house, begging for medicine to bring him back. The Buddha tells her he can help if she brings him a mustard seed from a household that has never known death. She goes door to door. Every house has mustard seed. Not one has escaped loss. She comes back without the seed, but with something else. She's not alone in this. Grief redistributed through story until it's a little more bearable. Thousands of years later, with all the technology we've built since, medicine, antibiotics that can do things we never dreamed of, screens in every pocket, more information than any generation before us, we still haven't found a way around grief. When grief hits, we still can't fix it with facts. We still go looking for another person. Hopefully, we look for another person who's never carried anything else for us but a place to join us, to help carry our load. And we learn through that embrace that we are humans together and none of us escape grief. We have a shared journey, and may we always know we are not alone. Here's what these teachers seem to understand long before anyone had language for it. A fact that goes into your head and stays a visitor. But a story gets in your head and rearranges the furniture. Tell someone, forgive people, and they nod and mostly forget it by Tuesday. Tell them about a father running down the road before his son can even finish the apology, and something different happens. They don't just receive information. They become, for a moment, the son, the father, the lecture that never comes, or the father who ran with open arms and didn't let go of that embrace. You cannot argue your way into forgiveness nearly as efficiently as a story can walk you right into it. The same is true of grief. Tell someone you're not alone in your loss. I'm here for you. And it lands as kindness, maybe, but it stays outside of them. Tell about a mother going door to door for a mustard seed, finding grief in every house she knocks on, and something shifts. They're not being told they're not alone. They're watching it become true, one door opening at a time. That's the operating system doing its quiet work, not persuading you of a conclusion, but changing what it feels like to be you, to be someone else, for the length of the telling, and then some. I want to tell you about a girl named Ginger. I was in my early 30s in seminary, working as a campus minister in the Appalachian area in eastern Ohio. My husband, Tim, was teaching at a small college in eastern Ohio and finishing his doctorate at Ohio State. I was in school myself, and I was pregnant. Ginger was 14. Her mother worked on the maintenance staff at the campus where I served, and Ginger was pregnant too. Her mother was younger than me. Ginger was being teased at school for it. Her mother was devastated, not just about the pregnancy, but because Ginger had already decided on her own that she wanted to place the baby for adoption. Her mother met with me first and asked if I could help. Then I started meeting with Ginger, tutoring her in math and language, and walking with her through her last trimester. And somewhere in those months, we became very close. Ginger's reasoning wasn't complicated, even though the situation was. She said to me, "My mama was 15 when she had me, and this baby will be poor, and then his baby's gonna be poor. It just doesn't stop." The baby's father was 15 too. Ginger hadn't even really known she was pregnant until she was well into her second trimester. She had no experience, and her body was so very young. By the time she found out, so many choices were already gone. Her mother kept saying that once Ginger saw the baby, she wouldn't be able to give him up, that he was hers, that he didn't belong to anyone else. How could a mother give away her own child? Her mother said she would be a stranger to her if she gave away her baby, but Ginger didn't waver. She asked me to be with her the day of the birth. The adoptive parents, professionals from New York, had already met with me. They'd set up a college account for Ginger. They were genuinely concerned for her, not just for the baby. On the day he was born, Ginger and the baby's father were both there. And I watched this girl who had just given birth hours before lift her son and hand him gently to the social worker. She said, tears just streaming down her face, "I feel like I'm giving a piece of me away, but I guess that's what love is sometimes." I was supposed to be her mentor, her minister, her teacher, but in those months, she gave me more than I could ever give her. And here's the shared language part. You don't know, Ginger, but now when I say the words love and sacrifice and what it actually costs, not the feeling of it, but the doing of it, I think of my teacher, Ginger, and now you might too. Our shared language grows through story. I want to guide you through a closing exercise of finding your own story. This is a quiet exercise. Just let yourself sit with it. So I invite you now to sit comfortably. And if you'd like, close your eyes. Be comfortable, or a soft gaze down. Think of one story, there might be many, but for this exercise, go to one. It can be a bedtime story, a family story told at holidays, a myth, a movie, a parable, a play you've watched a dozen times that has quietly been running in the background of your life. Not one you were taught necessarily, one that just kept coming back to you, that you kept returning to on your own. Hold it in mind for a moment. Let yourself remember not just what happens in it, but what it feels like to be inside it. Now, ask yourself a few questions, and I'll give you space after each one. What does this story remember for you? What does it keep alive that you might otherwise have let slip? A person, a value, a version of an event? What does it teach you that a direct instruction never could? What would it sound like as a flat rule? Be brave, forgive people. Pay attention to who's left out. And why do you suspect the rule alone never would have stuck without the story? What has it cost you to live out what that story teaches? Not the story's cost, yours. Where has this story asked something of you, the way love asked something of Ginger? Who is your Felix? Is there a story, invented or true, that you've told or could tell to someone you love to help them hold something they yet don't have words for? You don't need to do anything with what came up, and I invite you now back to the present moment. Just notice that it's there, that it's been there, running, maybe longer than you realized. And not just one, but I'm sure there's more. My son Jeremy still talks about Felix as a gift I gave him. 27 years old now, and he tells me he couldn't believe how much he loved Felix. We laugh now as he remembers how amazing it was to 6-year-old Jeremy that Felix had such similar challenges to his own. Jeremy majored in composition from DePaul University, and one Christmas he gave me a gift of his own, a piece of music he'd written for his senior project. It was a beautiful piece and the most precious gift I'd ever received. He didn't just remember the story, he internalized it. He also remembers the way I used to sing Puff the Magic Dragon back when he was small enough to still believe in dragons. One gray night it happened. Jackie Paper came no more, and Puff that mighty dragon, he ceased his fearless roar. Those words always circled the same truth. The boy grows, and what he loved as a child has to go on ahead of him or grow up alongside him. My son knew that somewhere in the writing of that piece, The Flight of Felix, a young man takes flight. So he let Felix take flight too. That's the whole operating system right there, the memory. Felix still running decades later, and my grandmother still part of that bowl. The values, what mattered enough to carry forward into something made with your own hands. The shared language, because when Jeremy wrote that piece of music, he was telling me in music that he understood something. Felix and Puff and every story like them have been trying to say all along that love lets things grow up and go. Ginger knew it too, at 14 in a hospital room, in a way I hope Benny never have to go through. Letting go was never proof that she loved her son less. She taught me it was the whole of what her love cost. You have one too. The story you just sat with, it's part of your operating system now. The same way Felix is part of mine, the way that bowl is part of mine and my family's. That's the whole point of the last several minutes, to recognize a few of your own stories learned, lived, and still developing within us. May it be so. This is the time now for dialogue. We invite conversation around, focused around today's presentation. We invite you to share thoughts, ask questions. I look forward to hearing them. I think I would say that my husband is a family and marriage therapist, and me as a pastoral counselor, and spiritual director, I would say people come with stories. And the first thing we have to do, the painful ones too, in all of our lives, is recognize they're there and then decide who is narrating the story and how might else the story be told. We cannot deny how someone feels, But it also, I think, points out why it's so important to communicate when children are young, to help direct those stories. So just a little bit on Ginger, she, thanks to the two men, the parents of the child, the little baby who was adopted, they saw to it that she went to college, and she has four children now, a nurse practitioner, and they see to it that she sees that child. They help build that story, right? So I think it's important to hear people's stories, listen to them, and perhaps invite new ideas within them. Stories are stories, and so I told you one narrative of that. You could repeat this story, and probably would, with a very different take on the story. So it's important to, I was the person who was older than this child's mother giving birth. But seeing the poverty around me and seeing that this was important to this young girl and watching her act on that with courage impacted me. But there are different and many different ways to look at a story. Thank you all. And as we go forward and think about the stories that we want to keep, the stories that we were told, and how those stories have changed in our own lives, and what is the difference between truth and story, through perspective, through age, through the person telling the story. May we find room for them and awareness of stories in our lives as we grow. We began this hour talking about story, ancient technology that taught us who we are before we had any other way to teach it. We've examined stories, the ones we want to keep, the ones we want to examine, the ones we want to let go. And we will close the way stories often close, with an invitation to know one another. William E. Stanford writes in his poem, A Ritual to Read to Each Other, if you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world. And following the wrong God home, we may miss our own star. I thank you for having me today. It has been a gift to be here again. I was here a few weeks ago, and it is a loving and beautiful space. I thank you for the dialogue, for both the acceptance and the challenge. May we take all of that with us today.